Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and once again, it's my pleasure to be joined by Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Fairy and the Monkey Virus, published in softcover by the Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. Ed, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave.
In a last half-hour segment, Ed, you were talking about a bit of spin control, and that's a euphemism, with regard to an NIH story about breast cancer. And you indicated that the way in which the story was phrased was fundamental. The way in which the headline was phrased was fundamentally misleading. I wonder if I could ask you to encapsulate the information that you provided in our last half-hour segment, and then carry the thought still further for us.
The content of the story was a comparison of the effectiveness of treatment plans between Canada and Cambodia. The headline talked about whether or not your risk of getting breast cancer was related to your childhood. Okay, those are two completely different concepts. The position that I take on the contamination of the polio vaccine is that the contamination of the polio vaccine is a major element in our increase of soft tissue cancers. And for the NIH to come out and say, no, nothing that happened in your childhood could be affecting your cancer risk, and using only the death rate of immigrants from third world countries as the basis of that criteria is fundamentally, it's propaganda with a capital P. It is fundamentally misleading the American public about the information that they we pay their salaries, right? They should be providing us with good information. Now, there are good people up there who like Deborah Dees from the U.S. Public Health Service, who on the front page of USA Today said, you know, we cannot explain the increase in cancer rates, which was 300% over the period they were talking about, by all the things we're talking about. There has to be something else going on. And of course, they weren't talking about viruses on the front page there. So I do not think we are getting clean information from the government on this, and I think it's got a lot to do with the relationship between the government and the pharmaceutical companies and just where the liabilities lie for this and where the vested interests are.
One of the things that makes me pessimistic about the whole question of the SV40 contamination of the polio vaccine and the generational implications for the baby boomers with its economic and political overtones, not only our history itself, in other words, take a look at the way the U.S. has been going in the second half of this century, ranging from the Kennedy assassination to all sorts of covert operations, the Gingrich economics in which poor people on welfare are basically being scapegoated and actively punished for America's economic problems, and they're not responsible for it. Or, for example, the apparent creation of AIDS and the dissemination of AIDS. Things of this kind do not inspire a lot of confidence in me with regard to a sea change offering a constructive approach to some of these things. Indeed, when you were my guest with Dr. Leonard Horowitz last October, along with Alan Cantwell and Dr. Garth Nicholson, Doctors Alan Cantwell and Garth Nicholson, Len Horowitz brought up a document that in which the Council on Foreign Relations recommended that the U.S. population be reduced to a level roughly approximate to what it was, roughly what it was in the late 1940s, somewhere between 120 and 140 million. That'd be a 55% reduction. The CFR is awfully influential, and a lot of the things that they want sooner or later come true. When I see something like that, and then I think about the baby boomers and the children of the baby boomers or the sexual partners of the baby boomers having a time bomb in the form of an SV40 cancer virus in them, it makes me extremely pessimistic. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think my pessimism is well-founded, or do you see anything on the horizon? And obviously you're much more medically versed than I am. Do you see something which offers some hope? Do you think perhaps what you think Mary Sherman may have been involved in could actually be done? Maybe a cancer vaccine could actually be developed?
The best news that I've heard recently on the subject of vaccines in general, it relates to AIDS, it relates to cancer, it relates to hepatitis, is the work that's being done on DNA vaccines right now, which is a brand new thing, and I don't think I'm cautious about brand new things having to do with the immune system. But I think it's the area of best hope that we should look at. Their experiments, again, with primates have been very promising if the information I'm hearing is accurate.
What's a DNA vaccine?
A DNA vaccine is one where the vaccine is actually given a script, and it teaches the immune system how to respond and deal with things. So it's programming the immune system to be more intelligent, not just Pavlovianly trying to train it to respond to something. And again, anything that is, and this research is being done at the Colston Foundation in Alamogordo, New Mexico, and I heard it on the local news this past week. But it was pretty interesting, stuff. So that's an area where there may be some promise in. There's you raised a lot of issues in your preamble, some of which. I don't have any good solutions for. I think our best way to fight back with all this stuff is knowledge, and I'm not really waving any flags on that. It's just the only solution I think we have on it.
Well, I think your comments, for example, about fascism and democracy, if you feel that the population should not be told certain things, something which would also apply to a Stalinist dictatorship as well as a fascist dictatorship, that certainly is an undemocratic viewpoint, and I think it is a viewpoint that could be fairly said to characterize an awful lot, if not most, of governmental affairs as well as corporate affairs these days.
As well as scientific affairs, because there's this whole niche of technocracy, where the technocrats don't feel that they should be managed or supervised by the non-technocrats. I mean, this whole relationship between science and society is really at the core of this. And it goes back to Mary Shelley's book on Frankenstein about, you know, the angry peasants at the gate with their torches and pitchforks wanting to know what's going on inside the castle.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't settled that issue yet. And what keeps happening is we don't want the public, the scientists don't want the public to know what the risks are in a lot of these things, and therefore they keep them quiet. And so we wind up with spin control. We wind up with a de facto corporate censorship in it. And I'm a little bit old-fashioned on this. I just think the best plan for dealing with all this is information and honesty and to keep it on the table. And every time we get in a situation where we start, you know, burying the problems like we did with the contamination of the polio vaccine and not telling people about it, I think it just puts us in a deeper and deeper situation.
Well, I think we literally are going to be burying the problems. One of the residual elements of the Cold War that affects us profoundly in the United States, something I spoke about on my broadcast last week, and that is what former Deputy Director of Central Intelligence Frank Wisner termed the Mighty Wurlitzer, which was the CIA's, or beyond that, the intelligence community's media component, which specifically was patterned after Goebbels' propaganda ministry. It was deemed necessary in the Cold War to bring our free press, such as it was, under control so that we could combat the Stalinist press, which was obviously controlled. Well, the Soviet Union is no more, but the Wurlitzer is very much with us. And with things, some of the other things on the scientific horizon, for example, Project HARP, which Nick Begich has written about. I know you're familiar with that book. The implications of some of these things are literally catastrophic in terms of the planet and our species. And yet at the same time, I do not see openness and fairness being even approximated, let alone achieved, with regard to some of these issues. I wonder how many Americans even have heard of Project HARP. And the censorship and the, you know, what could politely be called spin control and outright lying on the part of the government is, as well as the corporations, is something that I think so far, in my opinion, has been decisive, and I'm afraid it's likely to continue to be that way.
Let me talk about the subject of population size and density for a minute, because that was one that you brought up before and just kind of alluded to.
Sure.
There, because a lot of people just say, well, we don't have enough money to deal with all these people, okay? And that's the kind of population bomb issue. if you look at the history of population density, you have the general pattern is to have the most economic growth and most economic power where you have the highest density population. Okay, so there are exceptions to that, particularly where you get in third world situations and stuff like that. But in general, high-level populations, provided they are educated and productive, and their economic balance is working, works out pretty good. That's not necessarily a bad thing. We can handle a lot of population, providing we handle it in the right way, and the health of the population is an important factor in that. If we're spending 10 times more taking care of 10 times more than the entire population can afford to take care of 5% of the people who happen to be in a certain age or and situation, then those numbers aren't going to work out long term. But that's the problem. It's not the actual population density itself. It's a relationship of how are the economic factors working in there.
Exactly. But the way in which that is being approached in the society, in my opinion, is very counterproductive. Basically, if you're near the bottom of the economic scale, then it's too bad. And if you, on the other hand, are a CEO with a golden parachute, you're sitting real pretty. I don't see any signs of that being reversed anytime soon.
No, nor do I.
And so, hence my pessimism. Unless we see a sea change, I'm afraid that sooner or later, when the boom goes bust, and I think that's very likely to happen in the second decade of the next century, if not before. You know, who knows? It could happen sooner than that. When, in sort of the ultimate B-grade horror movie, when the Saudi royal family meets the Islamic fundamentalist movement, that could have some rather profound effects. But I'm afraid of an enormous catastrophe at some point between now and the end of the second decade of the next century.
Well, one of the things that'll be interesting is to see the extent to which the people who are high consumers of the current medical system, how their long-term health fares in comparison to those people who basically kind of reject that and assume responsibility for their own health and kind of get off that game plan. And you may wind up with a situation that people who are heavy consumers of the system, who are using a lot of antibiotics, et cetera, wind up with a worse long-term health record than those who simply said, I'm getting away from this system, and not. And you could, it's possible, this is only a theoretical possibility for the listeners to ponder, but you could have a situation in the future where the people who have consumed the most health care are the least healthy.
That'll be interesting to see. It certainly is something that, President Eisenhower said, the future lies ahead, and we'll see what develops. And jumping tracks ever so slightly, is there anything with regard to the information that has been released pursuant to the Oliver Stone film on the JFK assassination that you would like to call to our attention? Because I know you are one of those people who has stayed in touch with the ongoing investigation.
Well, first thing that comes to my mind about the Oliver Stone movie was I was delighted that he showed David Ferry's mice in there and talked about David Ferry working on the cure for cancer. Because that, as you know, is critical to my book. It was something I was very tuned into before he did the movie, and I had nothing to do with him doing the movie. But when I saw it, I practically stood up and cheered in the movie theater because it was... I had hoped since the 1960s, when I was in New Orleans and the Garrison investigation was going on, that someone in Hollywood, an iconoclastic filmmaker, would eventually stand up and try to explain Garrison's point of view from Garrison's point of view. And I thought Stone did an absolutely magnificent job doing that. In terms of additional information that has come out subsequent to that, one of the things that there's two points that come to mind. One is the point I mentioned in our earlier conversation about J. Edgar Hoover and Guy Bannister's phone conversations during 1963 and 64. I think that's an important point to show that Bannister was not a lone nut down there. He was cooperating with the head of the FBI in whatever he was doing down there. The the second area of information has to do, didn't come out of the movie, but is in the post-movie activities, has to do with a doctor by the name of Jose Rivera, who was down in New Orleans. And he came into the conversation. I first heard about him in, I was in Dallas in 1993 for the 30th anniversary of the JFK assassination, and I was attending a conference there on that. And I heard a presentation by a PhD neurologist down there, who, her name is Adele Edison, and she was given Lee Harvey Oswald's name and telephone number by this doctor in April of 1963, late April, early May of 1963, which was 2 weeks before Oswald moved to New Orleans. This doctor had Oswald's soon-to-be telephone number prior to Oswald moving to New Orleans. Now, just to help the understanding on that, it was the telephone number of the landlord in whose building Oswald was going to live, but it was also turned out to be Oswald's phone number in his era. So it does not imply collusion with the phone company. It's just the fact that somebody was so tuned in to what Oswald was doing that they knew where he was going to live in New Orleans before he even got there. And this doctor, this woman had very serious problems with this doctor on a personal level, and she gave a 21-page testimony to the Assassination Records Review Board on this. But I got very interested in who this doctor was because he was from the National Institute of Health, and he was handing out grants on behalf of the National Institute of Neurological Diseases and Blindness, and he was somehow involved in Lee Harvey Oswald. So I kept in touch with the people who were looking into this, and what we found out was that this doctor was an MD, PhD, who was a full colonel in the United States Army, and he was one of the Army's leading experts in biological warfare.
Fascinating.
Yes, and he had been with MacArthur in Japan, running the U.S. Army laboratories in Japan, and as you know from Paperclip and associated activities, we were debriefing Colonel Ishii in the Japanese biological weapons program at the time.
Right, that was Unit 731 in Harbin, Manchuria, and we basically incorporated the residua and the research from that project.
And then along comes Korea, and they have the hemorrhagic fever outbreak, and
mm-hmm.
This Dr. Jose Rivera winds up being the guy that the Army sends to the front line to manage the hemorrhagic fever situation. He comes back and spends 6 years at the Biological Weapons Unit in Fort Sam Houston in Texas, and then winds up as a board of directors of on the board of directors of the National Institute of Health. Okay, now that's all fairly consistent, except for the fact that there's a six-month period of time where this man, who's an MD, PhD, U.S. Army Biological Warfare Weapons Specialist, winds up teaching undergraduate biochemistry to a bunch of nurses at Loyola University in New Orleans, which does not even have a medical school.
Huh. Interesting. By the way, we should note that the hemorrhagic fever that afflicted troops in the Korean War is caused by the Hanta virus, which was not only a focus of U.S. BW research, but which cropped up in the Four Corners area a few years back. Go ahead, Ed.
And on the Four Corners area, there's a place called Fort Wingate where they store all the old nuclear weapons and biological weapons that nobody ever talks about.
Yeah, I've brought that up on my program.
It was 10 miles from Fort Wingate was where the first case of that was reported.
I know. There's been some speculation that there might, as Fort Wingate was being decommissioned, that might have led to it. I would note that an article in Science magazine mentioned that the Army had been very enthusiastic, the military had been very enthusiastic about the possibilities of Hanta as a promising BW weapon, but that the research was terminated as the Cold War wound down. Well, Congress laid out several million dollars to continue the Hanta research after this outbreak, and the researchers that are conducting the, quote, civilian, unquote, research are, guess what, the very people who've been involved in the military research. So I've theorized that perhaps what we're looking at is Fort Wingate Gate.
Well, back to Jose Rivera.
And Loyola University.
Because this gets into to where the JFK thing meets the bioweapons thing meets the polio thing.
Right.
Okay. The location of the linear particle accelerator, which I discussed earlier, that was being used to mutate the monkey viruses to create the vaccine to fight the cancer-causing viruses that were in the polio vaccine, that whole operation was located at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, which is less than 1 mile from the campuses of Loyola University and Tulane University, which are immediately next door to each other.
They sure.
Adjacent property line there. And this guy was there from the summer of 1960 through the spring of 1961, through that school year. Now, what was very interesting was Dr. Rivera in 1966 had to fill out a civil service review form, just as a routine thing, but I happened to get a copy of it, and he left this period off of his civil service record. In other words, he lied under penalty of perjury because he had to sign this thing saying, I understand that, you know, if I lie here, I can go to jail. He lied to the United States government about where he was between the summer of 1960 and the spring of 1961. Now, this is right when this linear particle accelerator project was starting up in New Orleans. In other words, I believe the man who had no other reason for being in New Orleans, no other reason to be teaching at a school that didn't even have a medical school. I believe he was there on a covert assignment, and that his position teaching at this university was part of his cover, and that his whole reason for being, I mean, he taught one introductory, you know, biochemistry class, and the rest of the time he spent over at the laboratory designing these experiments. And he was the U.S. Army's supervisor for... They wanted to look over the shoulders of what they were doing so they could find out if there was anything that was going on in this research that they should be looking at from either an offensive or defensive point of view.
Fascinating. Fascinating. It's interesting how many different tributaries of the research that I've been accessing for many years wind up crisscrossing with one another at one point or another. And, of course, linear particle accelerator was also quite close to Lee Harvey Oswald's digs in New Orleans, correct?
Yeah, so it was less than 1 mile from his house. In fact, if you looked at Oswald's house, the accelerator, Ochsner's house, Tulane University, they were all within a one-mile circle of each other.
Interesting. Do you think there's any possibility that some of the medical overtones and the scientific overtones to the Kennedy assassination investigation will get any publicity from other than Ed Haslam? Because this is an entire aspect of the case that I had never encountered before, and it appears to be fairly well documented, fairly massive, and more than little significant.
I don't really think it will, because I think if you look at who owns the media, and this is one thing that most people don't see, I forget exactly which network they own, but Westinghouse is one of the major investors in one of the big networks. And when you see relationships like that and you say, okay, well, what do these people do? And you discover they make nuclear weapons or they made nuclear weapons and they're involved in a lot of other things. You see there's a power alignment there that does not encourage this type of thinking. But personally...
I was actually thinking, Ed, of the JFK Assassination Research Committee, which I've been, research community, I should say, because I've been fairly disappointed in the post-JFK movie research. It's pretty much been the same old stuff, you know, counting bullets in cartridge cases and overlooking some of the more profound implications of that event.
I published an article in one of the JFK research publications, which laid on the table the theory, which I was proposing to them, that Lee Harvey Oswald was in fact spying on the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital on behalf of an agency of the United States government, and that theory best explained a lot of the issues about Oswald. And frankly, I just got met with a bunch of blank stares, because I think they've been looking at the situation for so long from their point of view. I think it was difficult for a lot of them to incorporate such a different perspective in there. And so I don't really know kind of what to say about that from their point of view, other than the fact that I am proposing a very different scenario on this. But I really think that if you look at some of the things about Oswald, let me just give you a few of them here, and I don't claim to be an Oswald expert.
Got about 3 minutes left, by the way. Okay.
If you looked at a map of Dallas and a map of New Orleans, and you put a big red star on top of where the federal court's buildings were and a big blue star on top of where Lee Harvey Oswald worked, you discover that in both situations he worked immediately adjacent to the federal court's buildings. I think that's an awfully interesting place for him to work in two different cities. Now, but if his job was either to pass information back to Justice Department officials who were associated with those buildings, or his job was to spy on people in those buildings to see if there was, you know, contact with known mafia people and stuff like that, then those would be very logical places for him to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when Adrian Alba testified to the Warren Commission that he saw Oswald passing documents back and forth, or envelopes back and forth, he didn't know what was in the envelopes, with people he knew to be federal agents because he owned the garage that the federal agents parked their cars in, and he knew these guys from being in and out of his garage. And everybody talks about this in relationship to the FBI, but the FBI is the department of the department, a division of the Department of Justice.
Right.
The Department of Justice, who was headed by Bobby Kennedy, parked their cars in the same place the FBI did. Okay, so we shouldn't jump to the conclusion that Oswald was working with the FBI. He could have been working with the Department of Justice and spying on the FBI or spying on the CIA or spying on anybody he was directed to spy on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this secret laboratory in New Orleans is one of the places he was directed to spy on. And it was one of the things, one of the reasons he was chosen to be such a good patsy.
Yeah, and indeed, one can see why the powers that be would not have wanted all of that information about the SV-40 to be coming out. It would have had enormous implications. It still does.
It made Oswald uninvestigatable.
Mm-hmm.
And when nobody wanted to investigate him because he was involved in things that they all had problems with, then everybody could sigh a big sigh of relief when they got rid of him. Okay, which was convenient to the architects of the event. So, anyway, that's my view on Oswald, for better or for worse.
All righty, Ed, we're almost out of time here. Once again, why don't you fill listeners in as to how they can get the updated version of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus.
Okay, the simple way is to call 1-800-MONKEY-X. That's MONKEY-X. The numeric version is 1-800-666-5399. You'll hear a 2-minute recording, and it'll give you the information concerning ordering and address. If you want to write, it's Wordsworth, that's W-O-R-D-S, W-O-R-T-H, one word. Address is 7200 Montgomery, M-O-N-T-G-O-M-E-R-Y, number 280, Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can abbreviate Albuquerque as ABQ, New Mexico is NM, and the zip is 87109.
All righty. And once again, this interview and the other interviews with Ed Haslam are available from Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. You can locate them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email address, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, that's A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E at ix.netcom.com. All of the tapes available from Spitfire, as well as a suggested reading list, can be gleaned on the web page. Point your web browser at www.kfjc.org. That's www.kfjc.org, and look in the public affairs section. Ed, it's been a pleasure and enlightening, as always. Take care and good luck. We've been speaking with Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. For Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.